Doesn't mean that I can't.
Okay, this is Linda Hurwitz and Priscilla Fidel for the National Council of Jewish Women Oral History 2 Project. On October 27, 1983, interviewing Aaron Kessler. Thank you, Dr. Kessler, for consenting to the second part of our interview. Let's pick up where we left off last time. In what year did you come to Pittsburgh, and under what auspices?
I came to Pittsburgh on November 1st, 1951, at the invitation of the United Jewish Fund.
For what purpose did the United Jewish Fund invite you to Pittsburgh?
The story is rather lengthy. In 1950, the United Jewish Fund established a self-study committee consisting of 139 members, all members of the Jewish community, who represented almost all Jewish schools and synagogues in this community. The committee was charged with the task of studying conditions in Jewish education. I said almost all because the only institution that refused to participate in the study was Temple Rosh Hashanah. The American Association for Jewish Education, with headquarters in New York City, was requested to direct this study. I was associated with the American Association for Jewish Education as director of consultation, and therefore it was my task of assigning a member to direct the Pittsburgh study. Following a brief visit to Pittsburgh, I assigned Dr. Uriah Z. Engelman, a leading educator and sociologist, to coordinate the Pittsburgh study. The study lasted 6 months. During this period, I was in South America. The Jewish Agency for Israel and the Ministry of Education and Culture of the government had invited me to conduct a survey of Jewish educational conditions in six countries. Actually, I went to Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, and Peru. On my return to the States, I was given a completed study of Pittsburgh. The conclusions and recommendations rendered by the study committee, which included, as I said before, a large group of people, among them lay leaders, professionals, rabbis and teachers, parents and alumni of religious schools, were as follows. That a central agency for Jewish education be established in this community to render administrative, educational, and consultative services to all Jewish schools. Specifically, they were to assist the schools in achieving the standards adopted by the community. It was also a question of preparing educational material for teachers and students, to organize educational workshops for teachers, to offer professional assistance on pedagogic matters, to develop a program of Jewish education for young men and women of high school age, to develop programs of parent education, and to act as consultants to the United Jewish Federation in matter of financing Jewish education. These are only a few of the many recommendations suggested by the committee. upon which the program of the council was built.
Did the study committee find that elaborate improvements were necessary for the for Jewish education in Pittsburgh throughout the schools?
I don't understand the question.
When the committee made these recommendations, did the UJF accept them as a reliable document?
I think I'd rather, at this point, explain the findings of the study. In other words, what did the study committee find that called for these recommendations?
That was what I was questioning also.
Now, I'm going to quote from a report that was submitted to the community in February 1954 by Judge Benjamin Lencher, who was the first president of the Council on Jewish Education. The report is extremely interesting because it begins with an analysis of the facts which on which the committee based its recommendations. Let me quote. In many weekday schools, the programs are so meager and disjointed that they have little semblance to an organized curriculum. In most schools, the subject matter studied manifests a lack of continuity, gradation, and lack of progress in the subjects and grade to grade. Too often, textbooks are used haphazardly and with little regard to their suitability for the age of the children. There is too much emphasis in many schools on the mechanical aspects of teaching, with no attempt at adhering to the most elementary principles of pedagogy. As a consequence, standards of performance, while differing among the schools, are on the whole low. Then Judge Lencher goes on talking about the one-day school, the Sunday school. The one-day-a-week Sunday schools could be effective educational institutions. Regrettably, they are not, because their objectives and curricula are formulated with no realistic appreciation of the limitations such a one-day-a-week school imposes. A mere listing of the subjects should convince anyone that it is utterly impossible to teach them all with any reasonable degree of success within Sunday school time and to children of Sunday school age. In reality, because of the limitations of time and lack of qualified supervisory and teacher personnel, most of the Pittsburgh Sunday schools do not teach, but only touch on these subjects in a very superficial and unsatisfactory manner. Now, in brief, the Jewish educational arrangements in Pittsburgh were among the most disorganized and poorest in the content and methods of teaching and learning in the country. In addition, the study showed that of the 4,000 Jewish children who were enrolled in Jewish schools, only 8 had continued their Hebrew studies after Bar Mitzvah, and all were 14 years old.
Was this study accepted by UJF as a reliable document?
Yes. Upon my return from South America, I was visited by Dr. Maurice Taylor, who was the executive director of the United Jewish Fund and of the Federation, who informed me that he UJF accepted the study and decided to implement the major recommendation by establishing a Council on Jewish Education.
Were you selected by the AAJE to establish this council?
No, it was Dr. Taylor who asked the American Association to give me a leave of absence of 2 years to come to Pittsburgh for that purpose. The decision to grant me that leave of absence came in October 1951, and I arrived in Pittsburgh on November 1st of that year.
When you came, so in other words, they brought you in to give a guidance.
To establish
a council that was recommended.
Six.
Okay. Did the schools in the community cooperate with you in establishing the Council on Jewish Education?
Now, the answer cannot be given in a nutshell, as this is neither the place nor the time to go into lengthy discussions what transpired in those years. I shall limit myself to just a few points. The council was established by unanimous agreement of the ideological or what you might call religious orientations, as well as by everyone who served on the committee, and that was a representative group. But it not, once it was organized, and I came here, if I found that the council did not receive the cooperation of all the institutions. The Reformed temples argued that they have different needs than the other groups and prefer to fill their needs without the help of a communal agency. The Hebrew Institute argued that since its school is a communal institution, there is no need for a council because they could render the same services to everyone. The Orthodox felt that the UJF is wasting funds on a communal agency. They would do better were they to allocate the funds to the two day schools, Hillel and the Lubavitcher, that were already in existence. That's the only one that supported the council and participated in its program was the Conservative. Now, on the other hand, in spite of the Reform and Orthodox public declarations, individual schools of all three denominations took advantage of numerous programs sponsored by the council. Specifically, they participated in establishing a uniformed calendar of school events, of suggestions for proper age grading of children in the schools. Also, they took advantage of certain consultative services rendered, teacher seminars, and most of them sent, again with the exception of Rosh Hashanah, but the others, the other two Reform congregations sent the teachers to some weekly, some monthly seminars. The only one that opposed and actually sabotaged the council was the Hebrew Institute. They would not permit anyone of their institution to go there because they felt it competes with the not the work but with the probably funds of the Hebrew Institute. Now, I think I should like to continue for a minute with Judge Lencher's evaluation of the council, because this is of historical significance. With the exception of Judge Lencher's report that was published by the council under the aegis of Federation, circulated in the community, there are no other documents available about it. Judge Lencher's report, written in 1954, concludes as follows. In conclusion, I wish to say that the Council on Jewish Education, in its brief existence, has applied itself wholeheartedly to the problem of improving and expanding educational opportunities for our Jewish children and youth. It has become the motivating power for Jewish education in the community. It has created a pool of pedagogical knowledge and administrative experience in the field of Jewish education. Individual schools have come to it for guidance and development, operating on the principle that it is a voluntary service agency. The Council has extended services to those institutions which have sought to bring improvements in their curricula, methods of teaching, and administrative practices. To these institutions, the Council has given friendship, guidance, understanding, and expert help. As a result of its labors, the community can feel the satisfaction that a more enlightened Jewry will grow up in the Jewish community in the future. I have no hesitance in stating that the action taken by the United Jewish Fund in November 1951 has borne real fruit. The general interest in Jewish education has been raised to a higher point than ever before. All who have a share in this wonderful work are entitled to a full measure of praise at such a high accomplishment in such a short time.
Out of all your work with the Council, how eventually did the College of Jewish Studies become established, and what was its purpose?
Now, the College of Jewish Studies was an outgrowth of the self-study. The self-study specifically recommended establishing a permanent training school for Hebrew and Sunday school teachers under the name of College of Jewish Studies.
For teachers, initially.
Training teacher. Teams. That doesn't mean necessarily that everyone attending it would become a teacher. At first, the college had two divisions. A department for teenagers, 13 to 17 years of age, a sort of preparatory school, and a department for older youth to prepare them to teach in Jewish schools. Actually, we opened the College of Jewish Studies with 18 teenagers from one school in Atlas Bechela.
And what year was this?
That was 1951.
That was 1951.
52. The people who participated actively in establishing the program and in teaching were Dr. Eunice Baradon of Bechelem, Rabbi Herman Kivel Datan of Bechelem, Rabbi Sima Cohen of Bnei Israel, and Rabbi Herman Halpern of Tree of Life. I served as dean, and in addition to being director of the council, I taught full-time in the college. The University of Pittsburgh accredited the college by granting 24 credits in Hebrew, Jewish history, and Jewish literature to students who attended the College of Jewish Studies.
24 credits towards their college education
Completed college education. It's interesting that when this request was presented, I made a request because I was, from the very beginning, a full member of the graduate faculty of the School of Education. And when I made a request at that time to the Dean of Deans, actually, was Professor Crawford. The university responded immediately favorably and sent in a committee of four deans and six heads of departments to sit in classes. And as a result, they saw my classes, they saw others, and as a result, in a period of a few weeks, I received an invitation from the School of Liberal Arts, the undergraduate school, to teach a course in religion and culture of the Jews in the undergraduate school. And that was at a special gift from the Heinz Foundation. And this was for a period of time, and I taught that course in addition to my work in the doctoral research and guidance and so on in the graduate school for 10 years. So the college did very well during those years, and from the 18 students in a very short period of time, it grew to 75, to 100, and to 200. The bulk of students were naturally of high school age, but later high school age, let's say 16, 17. All right?
Mm-hmm. Where were you holding these classes, if I may just ask you at this time?
These classes were held during the week in Bethlehem, and on Sundays, later we taught at Pitt. They opened for us the Litchfield building on Forbes, and they used two buildings, the building across the street, Litchfield building, and the student union. So on Sundays we taught in those places, and during the week, in the beginning we taught in Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. Later we actually taught in several places. There were classes in Bethlehem, there were classes for East End in Israel, there were classes in Tree of Life, because each congregation in those days was anxious to have some classes in their own buildings, but of course we realized...
It was the same faculty going and teaching these classes in different synagogues facilities, pretty much?
Not all. Because when all the classes met on the same night, they had different faculty. When some were free, they would move into other areas.
At that time, did they have, as you do today, a Hebrew department and a Judaic department, or how was it set up?
That was from the very beginning. The interesting thing, which is also, I believe, of historical significance, was that when I suggested the establishment of the college, I had in mind only a Judaic department in English. And this was because to provide instruction to people who taught in the Sunday schools and had absolutely no knowledge of Jewish history, or anything, or then any subject they taught. When, after we opened our doors, we found that many of the children and parents asked for Hebrew courses. So we immediately established a Hebrew department and a Judaic department. The Hebrew department has been growing consistently. The Judaic department has not been growing that much.
Why do you think that is?
Well, these are sociological factors as well as other factors. Hebrew was conceived as the language of Israel because of this religious aspect. Because also, when we introduced the idea of modern Hebrew, mm-hmm. spoken Hebrew.
Right, conversation.
Yeah, that's right. This was something new in the community because the Hebrew that they taught was merely like without comprehension,
right.
Just for reading.
Right.
You see, it was these schools were bar mitzvah factories. The teaching the kids what we used to call para-Judaism, repeating without knowing what it was.
Right.
Now we told the community that we are providing them with opportunities to speak the language in a modern sense and so on and so forth. To this day, the Hebrew department is the largest in our school. About 80% of the children attend, choose voluntarily to come to the Hebrew department.
And take the courses in Hebrew?
Well.
Or do they have some Judaic also?
The Hebrew department has most of the courses, the language courses in Hebrew, and history, and some other social studies in English.
I found it interesting when you said that they got 24 credits when it was accredited by Pitt.
Yeah.
Did that continue, or did that change over the years?
I had chosen to drop that very late. And that was under Dr. Litchfield. The reason was that on one occasion, Dr. Litchfield told me he was very happy that Pitt is able to give credit.
Excuse me, can I put this on your table while you're because of the noise in the hall?
He was very happy to that the university is granting credit, but the university losing too much money.
Oh, really? It has 24 credits that they're not getting paid
that's
for.
That's right. And the suggestion was made to me later by one of the deans that the credits be continued, but without the school. Our school make up the loss, the university. Now, that was not a foolish request. Unfortunately, when I presented the idea to the Federation, they wouldn't participate in the program. They wouldn't give us the funds, and we didn't have the money. And so, instead of getting into a hassle with the university, we decided that we're going to drop the credit. And it was a very fortunate idea that we dropped, because Pitt started going down and down financially, and it wouldn't have been good to say that we are responsible to a great extent in the financial, in other words, they are giving free education to Jews in the community. Mm-hmm. So, since then, we have been having almost every university, including Harvard, Princeton, Yale, where they have departments in language, and Hebrew is included in it, they give credit for the Hebrew. Yes. We are considered one instance when a student, a graduate of our school, came to Harvard graduate school in the Department of Comparative Literature. The requirement was that that student have 2 years of Latin and Greek, but when she presented her credentials from us, they waived the requirements.
In lieu of her having the Hebrew.
Yeah, they asked us, of course, to send in our curriculum, which we did, and they waived the requirements for Latin and Greek. That's happened in many other places.
Well, that's good. That's the strength of the school, definitely. Do you feel that the purpose of the school today is the same as when you established it?
Well, there are many purposes. There were many purposes then. Some of the purposes are the same and some are not. Because today we have a larger number of students who are teenagers and come in earlier, come in the age of 13. And therefore the educational program that they assume a different character, at least on the first levels, the entering levels. There are many other reasons, but there is one aspect of the school which is the same today as from the beginning. We are a classical school. It's a classical program, you see. It has been working beautifully.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that? Give us a little bit more information on that.
Well, you see, there are certain basic ingredients in the Jewish civilization of 4,000 years old. We are people. We are not a religious community like the Catholics or the Protestants. We are a people with a people's history. The religion is a people's religion. And the ingredients in that civilization, naturally, are the same ingredients as in any other national civilization. History,